Welcome back to our afternoon session. The first presentation is going to be a conversation with Nicholas Dennis. Most folks here will know Nicholas, and if you don't, Nicholas is an esteemed antiquarian bookseller with a great knowledge of manuscripts and books. He's also the nephew of Graham Greene. His mother was Graham Greene's sister, and also, as he was really important in the discussion this morning, his mother and his father were both part of SIS and lived in Istanbul at the crucial moment. And so Nick was very close to his uncle Graham and disposed of his library, and which is a very important thing in his papers. He'll be interviewed this afternoon by John Wise. John, known to you perhaps for many reasons, but especially for the three-volume bibliography which he and Mike Hill compiled and is indispensable to everything we do researching Graham Greene. And I'll hand it over to you now. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm genuinely delighted to be able to have this conversation with Nick Dennis. I had the privilege of interviewing him and Caroline Bourget in, I think it was 2017. Inevitably, on that occasion, we concentrated on Greene the man, Graham Greene the man, rather than on his works, although we did touch on that. But I would like to take this opportunity, because I know Nicholas has a wide and profound knowledge of Greene himself as a writer, and that's the area that I want to talk about, asking questions about this afternoon, which I think will be quite valuable to have his own experiences, his own ideas on the subject. Nicholas, as you probably know, was and is a rare book dealer, and he was part of, he had played a big part in securing one of the largest archives of Greene material in the United States. There are basically three large repositories of Greene's if you like, the main part of the iceberg in a writer's output. You only see the tip of the iceberg in the published work. The bulk of it is not seen apart from a few people who go and look in the archive. And it consists of things like manuscripts, notes, rough drafts, correspondence, and so forth. And in the case of Greene, it is huge. And there are the three places are basically in Austin, Texas, at the University of Georgetown in Washington, D.C., and at Boston College. And it's this, the latter one, that I want to concentrate on, because that is the one which Nick has experience of. The click isn't working. That's it. Thanks very much. And this is Boston College in just outside Boston in Massachusetts. And the first question I want to ask is, why Boston College?
Nick? Well, thank you for your generous words. I've never been there, actually. It's the first time I've seen it. it all got sent off from
really?
The UK. And I never made it over there to actually go and relook at it. But there was... I approached lots of people Basically, there was several in the UK, the British Library, Graham's College, Balliol, and the Bodleian Library. And then there were several American universities who had holdings of some kind. But the sort of background of this was that, as you probably know, Graham left his library and archive, or didn't leave it to me, he gave it to me during his lifetime. But it was clear that what he wanted to achieve was care for my mother, his sister, who had a really bad stroke, which devastated him. He had relied on her for, by that point, 14 years as his personal assistant. And they were very psychologically close. Although he was 10 years older than her, they bonded in a way that was stronger than with his other family members, even though they were very close as well. particularly Hugh Green and Graham had a close relationship. But Yvonne Cloetta, who was Graham's companion for the last 30 years, told me that in her view, Graham's health started significantly to deteriorate when my mother fell ill. And he was desperate to find some way to ensure that she had the means to be cared for. And my lowly status as a second-hand bookseller at that time was not sufficient to pay for the kind of living care she needed. So it was a fantastic gift by him. But my task was to make sell it in order to achieve this, because surrounding her with a lot of books would not have been much use. I'd been selling quite a few of his things before then, because he was very keen when I opened the bookshop, as he had often thought of being a second-hand bookseller if he hadn't been a writer. He kind of took an interest, and he came to my opening party and all that kind of thing. And one of the amusing things there was that Hugh was there as well, who joined me as my sort of chairman in my little company. And I had a copy of the Spy's Bedside Book, which was contributed to by both of them. And so I took it over to them and said, would they sign it? And they were very happy to do this, but they got into a kind of disagreement about how they should sign it. Which you might have thought would be simple, but Graham decided that they should sign this as a presentation copy to Anthony Blunt, who was Philby's one of Philby's five people. And Hugh said, no, you can't do that. That would be untrue. So they squabbled about this for a bit. Graham was much more willing to take risks, I think, than Hugh, who was pretty willing to take risks, but, you know, everything's relative. And so they agreed that they would sign it to A. Blunt, because that could be any Blunt. Sort of deniable. Fraud, really. And while I was there, a friend of mine who saw this happening asked to buy it from me. And he offered me £40 for this book. This is 1983, so £40 was probably 150 or something. But I didn't think it was enough for this august occasion. And so I said, no, that wouldn't be enough. And he kept coming back to me during the party. And finally, Graham and my mother and father and so on went to a restaurant, and I was going to join them there after I cleared up. And when I arrived, he asked me if I'd sold it, and whether I, and I said yes. What did you get? 240, I said, and he thought that was pretty good. So it was my first experience of sort of on the spot dealing. But what transpired over the course of time was that I became aware, through being in contact with people around, I suppose, who knew Graham or so on, but also from the way he was talked about by customers and people writing about his books, was that people saw his writing in a very personal way, that it seemed to kind of speak for them. When Graham died, my sister Louise, for instance, this is sort of one little icon of that quality, but she was holidaying in the Caribbean, and she was on a beach, and there was a beach hut manned by a Caribbean inhabitant, and she went up to get a drink, and he had a radio on, she suddenly heard it being announced that Graham had died. And she looked down and saw that the man serving was reading a copy of one of Graham's books. And there was a feeling that one got about Graham from a number of things like that, that his sort of penetrative power was very considerable. And people like Ronnie Challoner, who was a friend of, who had been an honorary consul in Nice, who was a friend and who had been in some secret work, like many people seem to be in my experience. When Graham died, he wanted to open a kind of museum dedicated to Graham. And he was clearly talking to me about the importance of this in terms of his identification as being Graham's honorary consul. Now, he was nowhere near Graham's honorary consul, but he kind of sort of felt about that, that somehow he incorporated that personal interconnection with Graham. The honorary consul, of course, was written about a completely different thing at a different time. But Norman Sherry too, Graham felt, to the detriment of his otherwise monumental work in some ways, was that he kind of over-identified with Graham and became very attached to being, it was almost as if Graham was a father figure for him. And there were lots of other people who spoke about Graham's writing as if it spoke for them, as if he said things about life and what it was like to be alive, that they felt ratified their sense of that. So I had this feeling when he asked me to sell the library and archive, that the bookseller world's view of Graham was not, as it were, as it was just a kind of a deal about particular books and so on, and he was one of the most collected, but you know, it was a sort of standard thing. But I had this feeling that a lot of people had taken his writing to heart more than they realized. So looking for a college, looking for a place to deposit it was, I decided on a strategy whereby I would get as many people to come and look at it as possible, and as many journalists as I could. I had about three journalists, so I got to come. When I received all the material, I stored it in the basement of one of those sort of big yellow warehouse type places. And I had a little room in there where it was so little, but everything was arranged like a little book shop or what have you. I could invite people down there to look at it. I had in the end, because my sister Louise also knew a journalist here, a man called who's head of Faber and Faber Publishing House for many years, one of their great editors, called Robert McCrum, and he wrote an article that he got published in the New York Times. And I had been told when I was speaking to journalists, well, you can only ask one journalist to come and talk about this. I managed to get three, but because they won't want to share the story. But once Robert put that article in the New York Times, everybody wanted to come and look at this and write about it, and suddenly this rule vanished because Graham's pulling power, basically. And I also decided slightly counterintuitively on a strategy where I wouldn't mention the price, which is a sort of difficult thing to do when you're selling something. But I had the feeling that if I mentioned a price, everybody would be coming, looking and thinking, well, is it worth it? You know, it's so much, you know. So, and they'd be worrying all the time about the money. And I wanted them to worry about that after they'd looked at the material and decided whether they actually liked it and related to it and so on. So I didn't mention the money to any of the journalists, but the journalists started mentioning money themselves. So I didn't really have to. But then I got all these universities to come to send their people round. It was wonderful because I didn't have to talk about the money. I could just talk about the books and what was in them. And also, if a person comes to look at a collection of books, you imagine Richard's books in an area about the size of from here to the technical equipment square. They wouldn't know what to pick out, and they'd miss things if they tried to. So they were very grateful when I just pulled out what I wanted to talk to them about. So I had kind of complete control over the conversation with the journalists, who are normally completely uncontrollable, which was wonderful. I'd end up going to lunch with Tom Staley, the head of Texas University, which is the largest collection of archives and books in the history of the globe. The people from the other universities. The whole thing meant we could talk about Graham at great length, in a sense. The emergence of the sort of who got it in the end, it meant that I was doing something that normally universities find impossible, because if they have to buy an archive, they have to raise the money from their own funding sources. And those funding sources are usually governed by bodies who meet twice a year, or maybe once a quarter if you're lucky. So there is a big delay for them. Because of the way it was being talked about, it meant that they had pressure on them to kind of get to it, in a sense. The long-standing university, which Graham had a big relationship, was Georgetown, and I had known them for a long time, Nick Sheets there. They were the front runners. I told them about it early. Joe Jeffs, who was the head of the University Archive, had just retired, but they had focused on Graham's work, and he personally and Graham himself had wanted the material to go there. What happened was rather strange, but there was another university which had emerged who I hadn't even noticed, which was Boston College. They had great difficulty getting their funding people to start up, but they began the process because Bob O'Neill, who was the head of the library there, was rung by six of his alumni, telling him that, you know, and the point was, they had a specialism in British Catholic authors that I had completely missed. I don't know why I didn't see them, but I didn't, in my trawling around, I didn't, just didn't encounter it. and these six alumni, several of whom were on their funding committees, said, you've got to get this. You know, sort of, go and get it. and so they came, but by this time, actually, Georgetown were well advanced. And we were about to clinch the deal, and I was sort of delaying a bit, but I didn't feel I could delay forever, because it wasn't kind of fair. So I eventually said to Georgetown, you know, we've got to come to a decision about whether you will accept the sum of money that had emerged. And I'm not allowed to tell you what the sum of money is, because there's a clause in the agreement that says I'm not allowed to. But it was, it's quite an old agreement, and they probably never even remember it was there, but it was a long time ago. But the thing was, they finally decided, they did, and we did a deal whereby I took out about 15 books that were of immense value, but not of great academic interest. And I said, well, if we take these out, I can sell them, and would that figure then be manageable? And they decided that it would. and, you know, books, those books were presentation copies, usually from authors of significance in relation to Graham, the most iconic of those probably being Vladimir Nabokov's copy of Lolita, which you may know Graham had championed to overcome the attempt to ban it because of it was considered a lewd book involving paedophilia and all the rest of it. But Graham felt that that wasn't why it was written and that it was an extraordinary literary achievement. And my daughter and I have had conversations about this because she was studying it as an accepted literary text in her university. So it made that journey. And here was a copy. It's quite interesting to me because the English edition was published in huge numbers, of course. So a hardback copy without a dust jacket would probably sell for a couple of pounds for a first edition. A first edition in the dust jacket was about 10 quid then. It's probably quite a bit more now. But, that's a bit of a problem. Excuse me. And a presentation from Nabokov to Graham, not to Graham, but to somebody by Nabokov, would probably have been around 150 quid there. But because this was a presentation from the author to the person who had most significantly championed it, I got somebody to give me 15,000 for it. So it's an interesting thing about association. So as you go up the scale of closeness of association and significance, the price. And I was a general second-hand bookseller. My book started at 20p. on shelves outside the bookshop. We had a few shelves for rarer books, and we did catalogues in some rarer books, but this was quite a jump for me as well. But anyway, it came to the point where they had, as it were, accepted, and I was about to go on holiday to South America to go into the jungle for 3 weeks and with my friend at the time. And it was imperative that we just finalize this deal before I went. And I rang Georgetown to say, are you sure? I spoke to the head curator of the library there. who had taken over from Joe Jeffs, or one removed perhaps. She said, yes, definitely we want to do this at this price. And I asked if she had authority to commit to that figure. And she said, yes, I do. I said, could she send a fax to Bloomsbury Book Auctions, who were acting as my agent, because I knew nothing about selling large things like this, legal implications and so on. She said, yes, she would. 3 days later or something, I was due to disappear off, which I duly did. I told Frank Herman at Bloomsbury that he was, to expect a fax from her. I went off to Costa Rica, and we arrived, and I thought, well, I better just check, you know. I was quite naive about these things, really. So I rang him, and I said, I'm just about to go into the jungle, and I have there's no mobile phones, you see, and certainly not in the jungle. I won't be able to do anything else. Have you received the fax? And he said, no, I haven't received a fax. And I said, well, that's extraordinary, because she's absolutely definite she's going to send a fax. So I said, could you please ring and find out what's going on? So he rang, she said to him, he said, she denied the conversation. So I'd never expected to encounter anything like this. I then said, well, can you please get back to Bob O'Neill, who in my naivety I had rung to say, I'm so sorry, but it's gone to the other people. And he then stood down all his funders and what have you. But luckily Frank managed to wind him up. So that was why it went to Boston.
Right, thank you.
long explanation.
Yes. In amongst that collection, there is a huge amount of correspondence. I think counted something like over 900 different people with whom Graham corresponded over the years.
I'm surprised it's as small as that, actually. He did have an enormous correspondence.
Right. And I just wonder, where did those letters come from? What was the source?
They all came really from Graham was doing well enough early enough to employ a secretary. Not all authors get to that point. And his first secretary was provided for him by Harry Wollstone, no less, Catherine Wollstone's husband, a lady called Doris Young. And she started work for him. This would be probably early 50s, something like that. And then she stopped, and he was looking for a secretary. And this is interesting in relation to you sent me those documents about his debriefing, I think they are, to MI6 about this Polish situation. He was looking for a secretary, and one of the other archives I sold was Josephine Reed's archive, who was the next secretary. Most of the correspondence that she handled for Graham over about 17 years passed then to my mother, who followed on from her. At the time, 1958, she sent a postcard in her archive. There was a postcard to her aunt saying, I can't come as early on Wednesday, whatever the date was, because I have to see the fourth Sea Lord. She was working in the Admiralty, no doubt already covered by the secret, what do you call it, the Secret Services Act, or the
Official Secrets Act.
Official Secrets Act. She went to see the fourth Sea Lord, and 3 days later, or possibly even the next day, she was working as Graham's secretary. Now that means that when Graham wanted a secretary, he could call on the Admiralty, high-level Admiralty person, to get him a secretary, like that. He obviously had an association with the Secret Services in certain ways.
Yeah.
So she compiled a great deal of the material, and the material was particularly good for the university because he'd had a secretary. All the carbon copies of his correspondence tends to be there, and as well as the letters in to him. So they see both sides of the correspondence. So it was a valuable historical thing in that, from that point of view. Then my mother was his personal assistant for 14 years. And then my sister Amanda took over. Mm. And after her, my niece, Lucy. So it was a very in-house sort of family thing. What was I going to say about that? The general description of the material was, as you say, plus the fact that it was carbon copies, really. And then there was also the books, of which there were about 3,000. And half of these were annotated by him.
This was Graham's personal
collection. Graham's personal library, yeah. So, and he had these in two places, really, which was Antibes, where he spent most of his time in the south of France. He usually lived in one-bedroom flats, so there wasn't a huge amount of space there, but he had three of them at one point, anyway. But only two did he keep books in, and the other one was in the Boulevard Malesherbes in Paris. So they came from there, and also he took a number to Switzerland when he left one of those, but I sort of collected them from all three places, and the last ones from Switzerland. To me, they were just as interesting as the archive. The agreement between me and Bloomsbury was that I would do a catalogue of the books, and they would do a catalogue of the archive. Do you have that catalogue?
No, I don't, no.
Because that may answer a question you asked later in this thing. College got all these things and a catalogue of the library from me and a catalogue of the archive from so they do have those there. Now, at least. The thing about the library was that it was Graham's habit when he was reading books to, as you, I'm sure many of you know, to annotate the book, to use it as a notepaper. So if he's sitting in a restaurant or on an aeroplane, whatever came into his head when reading or whether or not reading, he would write in the book he was holding at the time. And they form a whole variety of ways of annotating. I mean, he has simple responses to the text. And those responses, I don't know about you, but whenever I've annotated, I sometimes annotated a book myself when I was studying something or what have you. And then about a year later, I look back at my annotations and I think, what on earth was I thinking there? But Graham's annotations were always on the point, and they were always relevant, and often emotionally relevant. And, you know, so there was a kind of punch all the way through. And I think I said half of the books had either marginal lining or his distinctive way of having a little cross and a line down, a little cross at the bottom and a line up to show that everything between there was a matter of interest to him. And he said somewhere that he only did this when it was something that interested him. So we know that any of these things are matters of interest, and they form a wonderful sort of commonplace book of things written by other people that he had sort of fellow feeling for. So you can trace, you can take a subject like belief, for instance, and through a considerable number of books, you will find annotations or markings indicating that something being said about belief was important to him. That happened on numerous different subjects of interest, really. So they're quite a resource for enlarging what he has written to what he was also interested in and shared a perspective with. And then he also used the pages for plots for a short story or a play or stuff like that, or a commentary on something happening around him, or a diary entry, a whole range of ways. And you can watch in when he's reading Chekhov, for instance, there were numerous annotations. Chekhov was his sort of great short story writer. Well, a number were, but that, he had a particular keenness on Chekhov. And so you can watch, you put on here the House of Reputation, for instance. But the first appearance of the House of Reputation is in a response to a Chekhov story that sparked a series of comments there. So you can sort of see what a creative writer is reading in another creative writer and how that pings into something else. I think I've said everything was said. But this was something I wanted to say about that. One of the things that he felt about that was the complete opposite. He when he wrote those things, he wrote somewhere that he was very kind of happy to know that no one would be doing this, because all these books would be dispersed to booksellers around the world and no one would be able to trace his personal interaction with reading. It's part of his privacy. I mean, he was more concerned, I decided this and I know I'm right, he was more concerned about helping my mother than he was in that idea. And it was clear it was going to help my mother in a sense much more if I sort of ignored that instruction. He thought it would be dispersed to the four winds, but that means he wrote it in that frame of mind. So he wasn't writing these things in an expectation of publication. So they were a kind of, they were something from which one could, as it were, presume a certain integrity in that he was not guarding himself against other people's attitudes or trying to compile a thing. And one of the things that struck me about that archive, which I think is very important in my mind, because so many questions are raised about the integrity of Graham's belief in Roman Catholicism, or whether he was secretly having one opinion and actually was having another in the spying world or what have you, and questions about whether he was a double agent or treble agent and so on. But the thing about this immense commonplace book was that it was entirely consistent. There was no point, and I looked at every book, you know, of those 3,000 books, every annotation, every marginal lining. It took me 2 years to write the catalogue, but it was at no point was there any dissonance between his private opinion and his publicly expressed opinions. And indeed, there was no difference with his personal conversation. So when you spoke to Graham, you were getting Graham. And I think that's a rather interesting clue about him. The only time I never felt I ever heard him say anything that looked like an evasion or an untruth in my experience. I mean, people may have examples. We nearly all of us lie at some point. The only thing that I thought he didn't, he may not, I can't be sure at all, it may have been coincidence, but when he was writing Stamboul Train, there was this claim by Priestley that he was libeling him because there were a number of things, such as the character who was called Quinn Savory in the finalised version, but QC Savory in the other one. Priestley didn't like the QC bit because it was rather like JB Priestley, and the description of the pudgy hands and the love of Dickens and smoking a pipe and various things looked like a character too close to Priestley. And my recollection was Graham basically gave the impression that this wasn't true. It was an accident of coincidence and so on. But I do notice something that people don't mention on, perhaps because Priestley didn't notice it, so it wasn't in the list of things he wanted changed. But this character in Stamboul Train describes himself in the final version and the previous one as heading to China, the Far East, and places like that to set a book. Well, Priestley had just come back, or was possibly planning to go, because his novel, also in 1932, was called Far Away and was set in Southeast Asia. And that seems to me like it looks awfully close to home. I don't know for certain, but there's a possibility. But if it was, I suspect it happened because Graham was a young author whose last two books had flopped. And he was keen to write a book that really hit better sales. And he was also a person who, I think people often miss, because he has such a diffident manner when interviewed or talking, that he was an extremely assertive person. And when he, and you can tell this much more from things like his letters to the press or his criticism of other writers, which is a bit I wanted to say here, but I haven't run out of time already. But he was a sort of young writer who had very strong ideas about how literature should be, which comes into the seed cake and the love lady thing. And Priestley represented a kind of writing that he did not like at all, and he was wanting to kind of blow apart the idea of literature around him at that time. It was sort of young writers thrusting through. But he somehow ignored the fact that Priestley was the major writer for his own publishing company. So I think he felt, when he realized sort of what he'd done, I think Priestley might even be a director at the time of the Kahneman. When he realized what he was done, he felt a profound idiot. and may have just wanted to forget about the whole thing and pretend it wasn't, you know, because he nearly destroyed his career as a writer and therefore his family's hope of income. And it was quite a serious mistake. But I may be quite wrong. I don't know. That's just my thinking. That's possible.
Before we leave Boston behind, I want to ask you this. I mean, you alluded to it just now, and I mean, there is a danger in the whole thing turning into a Kim Philby fest rather than a conference about Graham Greene. In the archive at Boston, there is correspondence, personal correspondence between Greene and Philby, mainly covering the period when Philby had gone to had gone to Moscow, so post 1963. And it's interesting. It's not, you know, they discuss things like politics and so forth, but there's nothing special in there. There's another little piece, a little file, which covers Greene's visit that he made to Poland in 1956. And he went there and he wrote a couple of articles on the state of the Catholic Church in Poland at that time. There was particular concern about this movement called PAX, which was state-run Catholicism, because obviously Poland at that time was a communist country, and yet, because of the very powerful Catholic Church element in the country, there was the government had to allow people to practice their faith and so forth, although it was government controlled. So Graham wrote about that, wrote a couple of articles on that. But there was also, I found, in amongst the archives, and it was in an odd section, and this is all perfectly true. It sounds a bit like a sort of a tall story. But there was a section of miscellaneous files. And in amongst that, there was something about Graham going to Belfast, on the trips to Belfast. There was something about somebody asking whether he'd take part, whether he'd contribute to a book about sex scandals, which Graham declined. And then there was this third file, and it was titled Philby Kim, and inside that there was this document, was about 10-12 pages.
Oh, it's quite longer than what you sent me. Yeah.
Yes, and it was part of which I sent to Nick, and the if I get the, sorry, I've gone too far. Right, this is a page from this document, and it's all about the people that Greene had met at that during his trip to Poland. It's not directly. It's not signed Graham Greene or anything like that. It's just the report on the visit to Poland. And as you can see, if you look carefully, a few lines down, there's a handwritten annotation, and that is definitely Graham's handwriting. What I'm getting round a long way round to ask you is this proof that Graham continued to work for the for MI6 as a sort of intelligence gatherer? And the second part is, why was this in a file entitled Kim Philby?
Well, I don't quite understand why it's in the file in terms of that, because it doesn't seem to refer to Kim Philby at all.
No, there's no No, it's just as you saw that extract. It's simply about Poland. It's simply about the people that he spoke to, and whether the little pen portraits of various characters.
It's about 12 pages.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So yeah, no, I don't remember seeing it. And I looked in the catalogue done by Bloomsbury, which lists the contents of every file.
Mm.
And there was only one I found for Kim Philby, which was listing, as you say, there was the letters from Kim to him and various documents. The only unclear thing was that there were four carbon copies, which doesn't say what they were, but
no.
But if there were 12, it's not that. So I don't know where that came from. Maybe it was missed in the cataloguing. I don't remember it myself. I looked through the archive, but I didn't make the catalogue, and I skimmed a lot of it. But I would have looked at the Philby file if I'd seen that it was in it.
Do you think there were other? I mean, to your knowledge, did MI6 or any, would they have been likely to have looked at these at the archive and have gone through it, and perhaps there were other files in that
sort of pocketed
papers
it?
That
really, I would have thought they might do such a thing if it was that important. It was quite some time. I don't know. I have no idea, really. It's possible. I mean, people do go into universities, we hear all the time, and take stuff out. But an organized state extraction, secretly, I have no idea.
Seems to be unlikely.
I don't know. Maybe they would have to go in and find out what it was and then decide to take it, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
What was the first part you asked me?
Sorry?
Yeah, what was the first part you asked me?
The first...
Other than this...
Yeah.
Being a secret agent.
Yes.
Well, I think, Josephine's postcard and this, which clearly looks like... It feels like Graham, and it looks like a debriefing note to MI6 about his trip. And my feeling is that he probably did do that all along, but then... So did Hugh Green. And my understanding is a government is likely to call on any well-placed businessman or what have you who meets people they're interested in to give feedback. And they will almost certainly do so. And Graham had been in the service, so his association was probably rather stronger. And they may have enabled him to get into situations. But what I think that's quite a good example of is that a lot of people write about this. Was Graham a secret agent still, and was he a double agent? And is they're imagining a sort of an agent who is being dispatched like James Bond to do something specific. But actually, Graham, like a number of other people, had a contact list to die for, he knew everybody. When you get in his flat in Antibes, he's got a gift from Henry Moore on the wall, a beautiful Henry Moore painting, and then Fidel Castro has given him a Jack B. Yeats there. I mean, it's not like somebody who just happens to know someone. There's an unusual intensity of association. And because he was a person, what that seems to me to show is that he was basically like I think these people usually are. They mix with these people, they know who's who, they report back who's who, and they give their opinion of what it all means and it's going on. And they're actually, in effect, advisors, better placed than 90% of agents ever would be to interpret what they encounter. So they're giving that back, but he's not sort of employed. I don't think he was employed by the service. They may have paid his expenses to somewhere or what have you. That's my honesty.
Yeah,
I don't really know. Yeah. One of your other speakers might have blown that apart with some crucial evidence.
Can we, if we could move on from, I'm trying to point this. Well, what have I done? Right. We've got nothing at the moment. Okay, yes, thank you. We mentioned very briefly before that, and I discussions before with Nick, that Nick has a theory that Green changed very much his approach to writing in the period after the two what are now suppressed novels, the second and third published novels, The Name of Action and Rumour at Nightfall. And the next one after that, of course, is Stamboul Train. And I know that you've got your own theory about this change in his whole approach to, yes, to writing and his handwriting. And the picture above that is a key essay that Green wrote in 1934 with the rather strange title, The Seed Cake and the Love Lady, which I think is a reference to Ulysses by James Joyce. And perhaps you could just talk about your own view on this.
I think it is a really important turning point for him. You know, when he was young, and falling in love with Vivian, he was immensely romantic, and his writing was very sentimental and romantic, as he called it later. So, and that's why he suppressed Rumour at Nightfall and Name of Action.
Yes.
Sherry gives a sense of this because he quotes extensively, to Graham's dismay, from his letters to Vivian, which he wrote about three a day for 2 years or something. And they're outpourings of romantic, you know, they're quite painful to read for me. I find them rather. And Vivian was a person who wanted sexuality in their relationship to be entirely about procreation. And Graham, who was, you know, a sexual person and you know, definitely interested in falling in love and being in love and all the rest of it, he suppressed all that. In honour of this more romantic way of relating. He found his... I wonder if I could just read you this. And people who went to their house in Clapham, there was a famous description of a visit by an author to the house who found the whole sentimentality painfully saccharine and of their family life. But Graham, Graham's personal nature was completely incompatible with that suppression. He found himself confronting Vivian with the reality of his sexual interest spilling over into prostitution and so on. I think trying to sort of say this is escaping from our relationship. But Vivian wasn't interested in enjoying that. She had a very particular notion of what being married was, and that she would... there's a letter she wrote to Father Leopoldo Duran after Graham died, in which she was still longing for Graham to have been the kind of husband who they could have lived in Oxford and had parties with local dons coming round and local solicitors and people like that, and had a stable family life there. Graham would literally have shot himself. I mean, he would have... he couldn't have done that, and she couldn't see that. And she wrote to... He wrote to her a letter saying, I'm sorry, but, you know, I'm just not made for this kind of life. And unfortunately, all the kinds of things that I engage with are material for a writer. So for sort of every reason, I don't fit in here. And he was filled with remorse about that all his life. He never breathed a word of criticism of Vivian, ever. She breathed quite a few of him. He felt it was entirely his. He had let her down very badly. This was coinciding with the discovery that his sexuality, I think it's important, was not confinable. He couldn't control it or manage it within this context. And in this letter, he quotes... his notion about writing is changing at the same time. It's becoming less sentimental, and it's really important for him that he rejects the novels because they're sentimental. At the time when he was writing Istanbul Train, he was also changing in his diary, in that he was starting to write descriptions of things he was seeing around him and people he was encountering in a realistic way. And the more rapturous style, which was associated with beautiful writing and so on, he was abandoning. It's interesting, in The Seed Cake and the Love Lady, he quotes Henry James saying, quote, "Catching the very note and trick, the strange irregular rhythm of life, that is the attempt whose strenuous force keeps fiction upon her feet." Graham, in this essay, quotes and criticizes other writers such as Charles Morgan, very popular writers of the day, for aiming at the disembodied abstractions of truth and beauty, quote, "the jeweled phrase or numinous word," unquote. Seed Cake and the Love Lady seeks to blow apart aesthetic rapture as a form of writing, a veil masking physical realism. There is also a sexual content to his quoted examples, or lack of sexual content in the case of the others, of realism, which is absent from Charles Morgan, for instance. He juxtaposes two passages, one by George Moore, referencing the Love Lady, who seems a disembodied spirit with no connection to the physical experience and emotions of the characters he is describing as in love. The other is from Joyce's Ulysses, is Molly Bloom's final monologue, accepting Leopold to her bed and life, which references the seed cake, and passionately captures the strange irregular rhythm of life in Joyce's style of writing, and that he and Henry James sought to achieve. And to me, it mirrors what was happening in his relationship. For him, rapturous young Vivian, for whom sex should be almost absent, was being presented with the reality of affairs and prostitutes growing like a living weed between the arid slabs of romantic rapture, perhaps to persuade her to include it, and it didn't work. This was about 3 years brewing. Sherry, who does not find an explanation, nor refers to this essay, nonetheless describes this turning point well. In Rumour at Nightfall was his last novel to be full of, quote, sentimental cardboard figures, unquote, which is Graham's phrase. And he refused to allow it to be reprinted, as you know. At the same time, I've said that already, I think. So, at the same time, his handwriting changes. When he was younger, all his words had a kind of florid curl on the lettering up and down, you know, like that. He's probably taught at school and kind of thing. And he starts to write in his own hand, as it were. So it's a feeling that this is connected with his identity in his own mind. There's a principle. Yes, and around this time, you know, he was also having to deal with the phenomenal boredom that he felt, which seems to have been part of his manic depression, which resulted in Russian roulette. But for him, it's not boredom like we probably think most of us as a sort of ennui on a long afternoon or you know, don't we're doing it. He describes it as like an explosion in the brain. It's kind of unavoidable. And the Russian roulette was followed. If he played the game, risking death, then for a period he'd be left in peace, as it were. And then it would come back and he'd have to do it again. Incidentally, I should say that nobody in the family, there's often talk about how this is all nonsense and Graham was pretending, nobody in the family queried the reality of Graham's Russian roulette. There's a story that Raymond did, but actually this isn't true. The only person who queried it, Oliver Green told me, was his mother. Raymond never said that in his hearing, and in his view, Oliver's view, she was an unreliable witness. So he believed. My mother had no doubts about Graham's playing Russian roulette. There was no. And also, if you read Claude Coburn, there's an entry in his book about how all Graham's friends began to become very worried that he was going back to Russian roulette. You know, I mean, you know, having maybe schoolboys have changed now, but when I was a schoolboy, if any other schoolboy was putting on a drama about pretending to shoot themselves and what a terrible way they were in, and then you find out it's all a pretense, they would get a very hard time. You know, nobody would like being manipulated in that way. They believed that he was doing it, and I believe the reality of it for him, and the whole of his life seems to me to give it a perfectly clear context. But anyway, this principle of writing in a different way, where he's actually describing reality and using the skill to do that, as Joyce does, became a profound personal commitment for him as a writer, as part of his sanity. The writer must be engagé, as Fowler tries not to be for most of the Quiet American. And it is, for the young Green, a restructuring of his very self. He becomes a different person and a different kind of person that he wants to be. And it's like they say of painters, that the task of the artist is to see what is there and not paint their idea of it. And so they practice seeing a lot of time. Henry James and Green assert that all writers who wish to be relevant and capable of description must engage, see, and develop the technique, not of describing ideas empty of reality, but achieve the trick of life to present its breath and blood actuality. and maybe it's a strange term for it, but in a sense, political artists such as York Harding, I think his name is, who constructs the third force in Vietnam, devises policy from a set of ideas formed many thousands of miles away, with no encounter with the reality that Graham is living with. And the Quiet Americanist, in my mind, which answers another question you asked, is an incontestably great book, which means that unless we all stop looking at things as they are, which sometimes seems all too possible, he will always be a writer worth reading. Because The Quiet American extends this principle beyond description and technique, beyond The Seed Cake and The Love Lady. And in the extraordinary pressure cooker scene in The Watchtower, if you remember, Pyle and Farlow end up in The Watchtower in deep dark of night, and they're stranded when their car breaks down, and there's gunfire coming on as there's an attack on the road happening, and these watchtowers are there to defend the road, but all they find is a couple of boy soldiers with Sten guns in the top of the tower, and they're all hiding out there. And you've got, in this complete darkness, the presence of Pyle and Fowler's mutual antagonism under gunfire from outside and potentially within from the two frightened boy soldiers. And there you have this discussion about engagement beginning between the protagonists and intensifying in this pressure cooker of a dramatic scene. And I think it's one of the great, great descriptions in any literature. And the novel extends this all, therefore, from the mode of writing to the characters in the novel and to all human response to the world in which we find ourselves, and further embraces the level of international conflict, because it's the great criticism of the American war in Vietnam, which is a kind of idea about domino theory and all the various other things that were talked about without anybody actually looking at what it's like. And Pyle, who cannot engage and whose good intentions cause so much harm, is shown in his response to the bombing in the public square that he initiates to be psychopathic, completely ignorant of the human suffering right in front of him. And he's a bringer of catastrophe. Fowler finally comes to engage because of that inhumanity, to take sides in the novel and enable the death of Pyle. And it's not dissimilar from the psychopathically disengaged Harry Lime in The Third Man, talking from the top of the Ferris wheel about the tiny ant figures who can be just smudged out because he doesn't even really see them. They're hardly visible. and he's extending this to the entirety of Western policy in Vietnam and later North Africa. This is not an irrelevant book.
No.
It's not an irrelevant stance. You know, the quote, the heads, that phrase, I may have misquoted this slightly, but it's roughly, the heads did bob. This is about Vietnam, when he was traveling up country with the army, and he saw the river, and the heads did, he says this in answer to the people who talk about Greenland as an imaginary place. The heads did bob in the river like meat in an Irish stew. The dead child did lie in the ditch in just that attitude. Greenland is not Graham's country, but the world that engaged vision reveals, and only then in which we can act effectively and humanely. There's one last thing to say about this, perhaps. In his introduction to the collected edition of his works, Green writes, quote, "The subject of the Quiet American came to me during that talk with an American CIA agent on a long drive back to Saigon on the necessity of finding a third force in Vietnam. I had never before come so close to the great American dream, which was to bedevil affairs in the East, as later it was to do in North Africa." And just to finish on that point, in his book Heroes, much later in 1986, John Pilger, a youthful journalist in Vietnam in the 1960s, when the American, Graham's book was in 1955, as you know, who was winner of the UK Journalist of the Year in 1967, reports in his memoir that fellow journalists in Vietnam wondered if the overwhelming effect of the war put it beyond the power of journalism to report at all. He wrote, "It is an interesting thought, because one work of fiction, The Quiet American, still stands as perhaps the definitive reporting of events and attitudes which fueled the American war. It is regarded as such by many journalists who knew Vietnam and who, like myself, would ritually hand over a battered copy to those who wanted to know how and why such an apparently pointless endeavor could be sustained." So,
thank you.
Anyway,
that's yes. That. Richard, how are we doing for time? Overrun? There's just, I think there's, there were various other questions I wanted to ask you, Nick, but I am aware that we are part of a programme. Could I just, my final question to you was, if somebody came to you who had never read Graham Greene before but had heard of him, what would be your answer? What novel would you suggest to that person?
Well,
given that they were reasonably intelligent, sort of thinking individual,
they have to be if they're interested in Graham. But I think it's a very personal thing. I always find it difficult when people came into my bookshop and asked that question. That's a nightmare to any waiter. You know, well, what's good tonight? You know, what can you recommend? It depends on your taste buds, really. And it's the same with books. I loved, I can just say what I loved really, The Quiet American obviously affected me greatly. Travels of My Aunt is really, I find hugely spirited and funny. But if you want to get a sense of Graham's, the kind of punch with which he could write, his letters to the press, or his reviews of books and films, his film reviews can be, you know, devastating in a few brief lines, really, as well as very praising when it's something that he admired. I think his plays I've often found a bit less strong for me, but I do find myself going to them, and we've seen a few. And they actually always leave one feeling intrigued. And he was obviously very good at plot, because my mother invited me, this is relevant, you had in the Asson sort of newsletter that is produced here, Alan Bennett being rather upset that Graham didn't say anything to him, I think it was, when he came around to see his play. Well, I was with them on that night. My mother got me and Graham tickets to go and see his play because his friend Alec Guinness was acting in it. And it was on a theme to do with an agent. I can't remember it very clearly now, but and they end up compromised and how it's all worked out. And anyway, we were sitting in the theatre, me, my mother, and Graham. And the first act came to an end. It was just two acts, I think. And there was an interval. And I turned to Graham. I think I must have said to him, "What do you think of it?" And he said, "Ridiculous." I said, "Why do you feel that?" And he said, "It's all that can happen is that this is going to happen." And I can't remember what he precisely said, but you know, X is going to happen, Y is then going to happen, and then Z, and that'll be it. It's, you know. And I said, "Oh, but I think all sorts of things could happen." I said. And anyway, the second act started, and X happened, Y happened, and Z happened. And I thought, how did he know that? You know, and we all went backstage to see Alec Guinness, and there was a nice sort of feeling of old friends meeting, and they were chatting inconsequentially, and then all of a sudden the door opened, and the entire cast and crew entered Alec Guinness's admittedly enormous dressing room, and formed a circle. Sort of Graham and Alec and my mother, I think, there, and then around, I was somewhere in the circle. And there was absolute silence. And then some brave person said, "Graham, what did you think of the play?" and he paused a moment, it was sort of deathly hush, and he said, "I thought the performances were very good." And then the door opened again, and Alan Bennett came in, who missed that. And there, again, a sort of terrible hush fell on the assembled company because, in some ways, luckily, he hadn't sort of heard that, but then what do you say next? And then suddenly they all started talking and the moment was over. But Graham, therefore, never said anything to Alan Bennett, partly because everything happened and they didn't cross the gap or it was filled then with people. But that was why he had that experience. So, but I mean, I love Alan Bennett's things, but Graham didn't like that play.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Nick Bennett.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for a wonderful sharing of personal experience and huge learning. And John, thank you for leading the discussion.